From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, electronic money. Forget about cash in your pocket. In the near future, all our financial transactions may be handled through one plastic card. We'll talk with computer journalist Stephen Levy. He writes about e-money in the new edition of Wired magazine. Also, when the familiar world seems strange, we talk with writer Kevin Canty about his debut collection of stories. His style has been described as cool, clean, and devastating all-American realism. And defending the language against change, linguist Jeffrey Nunberg tells us about the French officials who protect the language against slang and English expressions. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Laura Kanoy. Incoming Senate Republican leader Bob Dole says he'll support President Clinton's nominee for Treasury Secretary Robert Rubin. The nominee is currently the head of the president's National Economic Council, which coordinates White House economic policy. Dole says Rubin is a man of honesty and integrity, but he adds he'll miss resigning Treasury Secretary Lloyd Bentsen, who steps down on December 22nd. A Florida judge has sentenced anti-abortion activist Paul Hill to death for killing a doctor and his escort at a Pensacola abortion clinic. Debbie Elliott reports.
Hill showed little emotion as Circuit Judge Frank Bell sentenced him to die in Florida's electric chair for the July murders of Dr. John Britton and James Barrett. After he handed down the sentence, there was an outburst from a woman who stood and shouted, "The blood of this man is on your hands, Your Honor," before she was removed from the courtroom. Hill's supporters say he was unjustly denied his defense, that it was justified to kill in order to prevent abortions. They warn that others will take up Hill's cause and use deadly force to stop abortion. Judge Bell assigned the public defender's office to assist Hill with his automatic appeal on the death sentence. For National Public Radio, I'm Debbie Elliott in Pensacola, Florida.
Former Vice President Dan Quayle was released from the hospital today after being treated for blood clots in his lungs. Quayle said he felt good and that his illness will not affect his political timetable. The Indiana Republican said he'll decide soon after the new year whether to run for president. North Carolina Senator Jesse Helms has launched a sharp attack on the media. Helms says reporters misrepresented his comments last week about President Clinton. Adam Hochberg of member station WUNC reports.
Helms set off a controversy last week when he told a reporter from the Raleigh News and Observer that President Clinton is so unpopular in North Carolina that he better bring a bodyguard if he visits the state's military bases. Helms later said he was clearly joking when he made that remark, but he says the media reported the statement as if he were serious.
You were suckers for the Raleigh News and Observer. The Raleigh News and Observer took the word jokingly out of the report, and you all helped circulate it across America. Now, do you feel like you're serving America when you do things like that?
In his first public appearance since the controversy last week, Helms confronted a group of reporters outside of a convention hall where he had just spoken to a farm group. He called the controversy over the bodyguard remark, quote, a non-story. For National Public Radio, I'm Adam Hochberg in Winston-Salem, North Carolina.
The Energy Department says the country's nuclear weapons facilities have so many flaws they could be dangerous to people who work there and perhaps the general public. A department study of 13 sites found nearly 300 environmental, safety, and health problems. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is down 1.69 at 3740.23 in heavy trading. This is NPR News. A new report says college students who are binge drinkers make life miserable for those who aren't. A Harvard University team interviewed more than 17,000 students on 140 campuses. Nearly 20% were defined as frequent binge drinkers, gulping 4 or 5 drinks in a row more than once a week. The study's author says bingers affect other students in a number of ways, including physical assault, sexual harassment, property damage, and interrupted sleep. Mexico's new president, Ernesto Zedillo, will present his plan to reform the country's notoriously corrupt judicial system today. NPR's David Wellner reports.
President Zedillo announced his initiative to shake up Mexico's judiciary in a nationally broadcast message to the nation last night. We Mexicans, he said, need, want, demand, and deserve an efficient judicial system. More than 3 out of 4 Mexicans surveyed say they have absolutely no faith in their judiciary, which is better known for its corruption than for its efforts to impart justice. Zedillo's drive to reform the judiciary was unveiled just 4 days after he took office for a 6-year term. He proposes that an independent board appoint judges, that Congress confirm the appointment of an attorney general in open hearings, and that there be what he calls a profound transformation of Mexico's police forces. Zedillo offered no specifics, though, on just how that would happen. I'm David Walnut in Mexico City.
Former Surgeon General Everett Koop calls the growing number of seriously overweight Americans an epidemic. At the White House today, Koop unveiled a new campaign called Shape Up America. It's an effort to educate people about the health benefits of exercise and losing weight. Koop says about 300,000 Americans die prematurely each year because of health problems related to obesity. Delegates to the Conference on Security and Cooperation in Europe have agreed to send a peacekeeping force to the war-torn region of Nagorno-Karabakh inside Azerbaijan. Armenian Azerbaijan have been fighting for control of the enclave. I'm Laura Kanoy, NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Electronics and computers have already changed how we deal with money through ATM machines and credit cards. The next advance might get rid of cash altogether. Electronic money, or e-money, is on the way. My guest Stephen Levy looks ahead at e-money in the December issue of Wired, the cyberculture magazine. Levy has been writing about computer culture for years. He's the author of the book Hackers and Artificial Life about artificial intelligence. His book Insanely Great on the history of the Macintosh has just come out in paperback. He's now working on a book about digital cryptography. E-money would make it possible for you to carry one plastic card instead of money. I asked Stephen Levy how that would be different from an ATM card.
Well, ATM machines are, in essence, a withdrawal from the bank that's done by a machine as opposed to a teller. Electronic money is going to be the replacement of the cash in your pocket with some sort of digital equivalent, and that makes a lot of difference.
So give me an example of what it might be like to shop if I had e-money.
Well, since you use credit cards, you probably use credit cards, you're familiar with using plastic to buy things. The difference would be that the things that you normally pay for with cash would also be paid with probably something called the smart card, which looks like a credit card but actually has a computer chip on it. And you would buy not only purchases from clothing at the Gap or whatever, but you'd go to McDonald's and you'd use a smart card there. You might even give it to your news vendor at the corner. You'd use it for phones. And you might even give it to the mendicant down the street who asks you for some money. She will have a smart card reader, and you could just flick it in and, you know, say how much money you want to give to the person asking for some help.
What are some of the problems or deficiencies with actual money that electronic money would address?
Actually, money is pretty messy. It costs, billions of dollars of people to process it. And one of the things I got into when I was doing the e-money story for Wired was I really learned from people who handle money how expensive and unpleasant it is to use it. You know, there's a whole infrastructure of protecting this money, because once you lose it, unless you have the serial numbers marked down, you really can't trace it. Even if you have the serial numbers marked down, people don't check it as they take it. So there's a whole infrastructure of Brinks guards and accounting that goes into it that we wind up paying on with all our purchases. So if we got rid of those costs, presumably electronic money could be cheaper than real money.
But isn't there like a huge bureaucracy that would be in place if we were using completely computerized money?
It's kind of interesting. The way it's shaping up, and this in a sense is a little alarming, is that it's going totally of its own volition. There's no regulatory commission looking at it. The government really doesn't seem to have much interest in printing, so to speak, electronic money the way they print physical money. So we're going to have, unless something moves in to stop it, a whole series of dozens, maybe even hundreds of private currencies that are going to circulate both in these smart cards and, probably even more so on computer networks.
Now, I know when I use my credit card, when my bill comes due, then I first have to go to the bank, get out the money, get a check, mail it to the credit card company. I wouldn't have to do that with e-money. It's just one step. It gets deducted from your account through your card, and that's it. There's no follow-up.
Exactly. At a much earlier point, the bank might get involved, or you might have your payroll go directly to some sort of digital wallet you have, and you'll pay out from there. So the bank might never get involved in this. You might have certified digital cash paid to you as part of your job, and then you would pay it out for your mortgage or your car or whatever bills you have. Now, the key is, and as I explain this, maybe you're thinking, gee, where does this get traced? That you can make this electronic money either anonymous or traceable. And if it's anonymous, the government has quite a problem tracking where this money goes, how much you get. And, some people, particularly, I guess, those in the IRS, are aghast at the thought of anonymous electronic money coming into being.
Why is the IRS so upset about it?
Well, the way they keep an eye on us, so to speak, isn't so much, what we report. To a certain extent, what we report to the IRS is voluntary, but the way they check things off is our employers give us money, and then they report how much money they pay to us. And the banks keep records on, where we store our money and, what goes in and what goes out. So all this is a check against the essentially voluntary nature of the way we report things to the IRS. Now, if there were no accounting mechanisms to keep track of this, we would be on a total honor system of what we report to the IRS. And, once people perceive that there's no penalty, there's no way they can catch you, the suspicion is that people might not be as honest as they are now.
Traceability is one of the really big controversies now in these early stages of electronic money. Would you describe what traceability is?
Sure. When you have a credit card, particularly some of the gold versions of credit cards, at the end of the year, you get a report which says everything you've spent on this credit card, and they break it down by category. And if you use that one credit card a lot, as it turns out, it's almost the diary of where you've been, where you've spent money. And, in theory, I guess you could even go back to the stores and check their accounts, and you can see what you've read and if they keep track of the books in the books you buy, the bookstore you buy books at, and et cetera. Now, that's only for that credit card, and you could avoid being traced on that if you want to buy something that you don't want a record of, at, say, an adult bookstore, by paying cash. Now, if we're using digital cash and it's traceable, virtually everything you buy can be traced. That end-of-the-year accounting can go back in the detail of saying, on this morning, so-and-so bought a New York Times and then went into an adult bookstore and bought these publications. So having total traceability can be dangerous in a lot of ways. And a lot of people are very uncomfortable with having the same degree of traceability with cash that we have with credit cards.
So who's for traceability? Who's against it?
Well, as you might suspect, the IRS kind of likes traceability. And law enforcement is, again, as you might suspect, is, very eager not to see electronic cash come in an untraceable way. Really, this could be a paradise for money launderers. The whole infrastructure of sending money overseas and laundering it through so-called legitimate publications that underground organizations, the mafia, might use could, be totally eliminated. They could do this without any problem at all. And this makes law enforcement very nervous. They have a nightmare of seeing the whole drug economy, freed of some of its most onerous burdens. On the other hand, they see a great opportunity for traceable cash, and in that it can almost eliminate the black market, the underground economy, by keeping track of everything.
And people who are opposed to traceability who are afraid that it will violate their privacy.
Absolutely. Privacy groups are very concerned about this. Since we don't have electronic money right now, it's sort of an abstraction to a lot of citizens. But as I talked to one person working for DigiCash, which is a company that wants anonymous money to come into play, he says, when you start to tell people that every penny you spent will be traced, people become a little uncomfortable.
My guest is computer columnist Stephen Levy, and he has a new article in the latest edition of Wired magazine about electronic money. Stephen, do you think electronic money is definitely the wave of the future?
I don't see how it could be stopped. As you said in the top of the show, we do have a lot of forms of electronic money, whether it's using ATM machines, changing that electronic money from the bank to cash were credit cards. And certainly the banks are very familiar with the concept of electronic money. All the big money really is electronically held.
Already?
Yeah.
Now, what about my security? Say we have an electronic money system and all my money is represented on a card. What if I lose it?
Depending on the system. That's one drawback of anonymous cash. In a lot of the schemes where the money would be anonymous and untraceable, if you lost the card, you'd lose the money. So what you would do to prevent that is not download big sums into the card. You wouldn't carry around a card with, you know, $3,000, say, worth of electronic money, no more than you would carry around $3,000 in your wallet.
Do the people who are working on electronic money systems believe that electronic money will totally replace real money? Will there be a day when there are no pennies and dollar bills anymore?
I find that hard to believe personally. Take a look at how people hold on to their pennies. I think there's been a lot of attempts to, you know, get rid of pennies, which basically just gather around until people have them in jars so big that the banks won't even take them and cash them in. Yet people are attached to them. I think the same thing's going to happen to physical money, that it's going to be politically very difficult to get rid of it. But we're just going to see more and more places that eventually decide not to take physical money.
Do you think that money is going to have an existential crisis?
I think so. You know, and we haven't talked a bit about money on the network, and I think that's really a very big area that's going to make a big difference. But when things become totally electronic, money becomes very much different. It's less of something you pull out of your pocket and spend, as more as one of your features, like who you are. You know, I play sometimes these, you know, kind of Dragons and Dungeons adventure games, and these characters all have certain attributes of power and strength, and money is one of them. And I think we're going to walk around like that with one of our attributes is just, you know, a cash flow. And you won't think of, you know, buying something is spending money, but more like releasing some of your energy, and something else will come back to you through that. So I think that the transition of money from the temporal to the cyberspatial version is really going to make a difference of the way we, you know, think about it and the way we spend things.
What's already in the works here?
Okay, there's been an explosion, just literally in the past couple months, of schemes of people wanting to get into this gold rush. It's almost an oxymoron here, of electronic money. All the credit card companies are looking to expand their operations from, you know, straight, you know, plastic billing, you know, from merchants the way they have now, into some sort of cash, you know, smart card system, Visa and MasterCard. The banks, of course, are extremely interested. And they're all madly making alliances with computer companies and cryptography companies to, you know, make these systems secure. So there's probably a half dozen consortiums being formed just in the last year to bring some form of electronic cash to market.
Can you describe a couple of the systems that are already operating?
Okay, well, there's one called Mondex, which is, you know, rolling out next year in England, and they estimate for their first rollout in Swinton, England, they'll have about 40,000 users of these smart cards, and these will be fairly anonymous. They'll be untraceable once you download them. Some people have actually asked questions. They think that the way this particular system is set up, it might be possible to hack. But of course, the people rolling it out are, you know, say that there's no way that anything could go wrong, and that'll be interesting to see next year. There's a pilot project going on with this company called DigiCash, which is run by a fellow named David Chaum, who really is the father of anonymous electronic cash, and that works on the network. And right now, they're, you know, giving you the ability to buy information on the net and transfer money from your electronic account, to the place that's selling the information, and that happens all anonymously. The most talked about electronic money venture, we haven't seen the fruits of yet, but when Microsoft bought Intuit, which is a company which gets into personal finance software and has been, you know, working with check operations, it's part of a ongoing Microsoft project in electronic money. They have about 5 or 6 cryptographers working there. And some people think that we might exchange our dollar bills for bill dollars one day, that every time you spend some money, Microsoft might get a portion of a penny or maybe a couple cents from the exchange.
If we go to electronic money, might there be a day where the whole computer system crashed and we were all suddenly broke? The equivalent of a stock market crash, but something more far-reaching?
Yeah, the specter of an electronic Chernobyl is one which has not escaped the people who are working in digital cash. But the funny thing is, in looking into this, is that the infrastructure for the total disaster is already there. Really, as I said before, the big money is already electronic. There's trillions of dollars every day that pass through electronically. So, this danger really is something, is kind of a sort of Damocles lurking over us as we speak. And we can only hope that the, backup systems are in place to prevent this happening.
Electronic money wouldn't be possible without cryptography. Why are the two so entwined?
Cryptography is the only way you could really make this stuff secure. A digital dollar really is just a string of numbers. And the same way cryptography has a goal of keeping things secret, of keeping things secure when they're passed over insecure channels, through satellites or through the phone system, anything people can get at it. Your money obviously has to be very secure in doing this. Now, banks have used some form of cryptography for years to keep their transactions private and secure. And, you couldn't imagine having the electronic money without strong cryptography.
My guest is Stephen Levy. He's a journalist who writes about computer culture. We'll be back after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with Stephen Levy. He writes about e-money in the December issue of Wired. I think it might be a good idea for you to give a basic definition of what cryptography is.
Sure. Cryptography really is the use of secret codes or ciphers to protect communications, to make communications more secure, or to make documents such that people can't read them. It is many centuries old. Julius Caesar used cryptography. It's only been in the last few decades that the mathematicians have come up with codes that they believe are uncrackable. And it's only been in the past few years that we've come up with systems that just plain people can use this uncrackable cryptography.
What are the security features needed to make an electronic money system work?
Essentially, what you need is to make the money counterfeit-proof, which is quite a challenge, because when you're talking about basically a big number representing cash, fungible cash that you could spend, what is more easy to copy than a string of digits? So it seems almost counterintuitive that you could have some security in a long string of numbers. And that's where this fellow I mentioned, David Chaum, has done a lot of really innovative work in protecting the security of a string of numbers. I guess even before Chaum, there was a huge breakthrough in cryptography about 20 years ago called public key cryptography that not only provided security, but gave a means of authentication, the equivalent of a digital signature, which verifies information as being legitimate, as being either from a certain person or authorized by a certain entity. So this digital cash, this string of numbers, is authorized, in essence, backed by a bank or whatever agency authorized it, by use usually of this digital signature technology.
My guest is Stephen Levy. He's the author of the book Insanely Great, which is a history of the Macintosh computer. He's a columnist for Macworld. In the current edition of Wired, he has an article about electronic money. Now, cryptography, which is going to make electronic money possible, is really one of the bigger controversies within the cyber world now. What's the debate about?
Well, the debate is whether we're going to have strong cryptography to ensure our privacy, to protect our money, really, in, you know, whether the strong cryptography is going to be, you know, used in everyday transparent means, meaning people will use it without thinking about it, or whether we'll either have a weakened version of cryptography, or, you know, one which the government can overturn, you know, very easily in its place. Cryptography, to protect our communications, to protect our money, is going to be inevitable. But this is an incredible threat to our government and other governments around the world that see the loss of control of listening to people's communications. And, you know, as we talked about earlier, in, you know, keeping track of the way money flows. So this is one of the big battles of cyberspace, really. Who's going to control the cryptography? Is cryptography going to run free and have what some people call the system of crypto anarchy? Or is the government going to rein it in and, you know, will trade off some degree of privacy and security for what the government says is, you know, can benefit the society in terms of curbing in criminals and protecting our national security?
There are different approaches to cryptography that could be used now within the computer world. One approach would be I could send a message to you and absolutely nobody but you would be able to figure out what I had sent you. The government couldn't find out. No one could break the code. But there's another form of cryptography that would allow the government, with a warrant or whatever, to break in and figure out what it was I had sent you.
Yeah, the big breakthrough that I referred to earlier, about 20 years ago, kind of ensured that the technology is there for us to communicate in total privacy if the system's strong enough. And, you know, indeed, systems have been developed and are being circulated to do that. What the government wants is a second form, you know, giving us that strong cryptography, but asking us to yield the government the means to unscramble these codes that we're going to use to communicate with each other in case they have a warrant or it's a national security matter. And this is something called key escrow. It's the equivalent of saying, well, you could have a very strong door to protect intruders from breaking down the door, but you have to leave a key to this door at the police station in case we get a warrant and have to come in and search your apartment or home.
Now, on the other side, you have an interesting assortment of people, you know, ranging from Rush Limbaugh to the ACLU, who are saying we can't give the government the right to intercept our messages. We want privacy.
Yeah, there's two problems with what the government's proposing. First of all, is that what they're suggesting is that people yield their privacy before the point they're under suspicion of anything. And I don't know if there's a constitutional problem with that, but certainly it doesn't feel right to a lot of people to say, you know, well, I'm going to leave this key at the police station, essentially, in case, you know, at some later point there's a warrant against me. The second problem is that some people say it's impossible to enforce anyway because the information to do this cryptography, to do this coding and scrambling is out in the open, and people can use it whether the government tells them not to do it or not. So, you know, the only people who are really going to get caught in this escrow trap are the people who are law-abiding citizens, give up their keys to the government voluntarily. It's quite possible to sidestep what the government wants to do by using these very available means of cryptography.
So there are some pretty big decisions that have to be made in the near future about cryptography, about electronic money. Who's in charge of making the decisions?
Well, the government has a big say in all this. The Clinton administration is, you know, a very strong believer in key escrow, in limiting cryptography and not seeing crypto anarchy, as you know, some people called cypherpunks who are activists in this field put it. So they want to try to stem the tide of technology, really, and keep this stuff from spreading very widely.
Stephen Levy, thank you very much for talking with us.
My pleasure.
Stephen Levy is writing a book on cryptography. His article on e-money is published in the December edition of Wired, and his book Insanely Great on the History of the Macintosh Computer has just been published in paperback. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is now available on cassette. To order, call 1-800-934-6000. That's 1-800-934-6000.
The cost is $9.95 plus shipping and handling. Not all programs are available.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Coming up, writer Kevin Canty. One reviewer says that Canty joins the ranks of Joyce Carol Oates, Joan Didion, and Raymond Carver in his ability to keep us reading about people we'd cross the street to avoid if we encounter them in real life. Canty's debut collection of short stories is called A Stranger in This World. And linguist Jeffrey Nunberg reflects on the French officials who have the job of defending their mother tongue. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Laura Kanoy. In Little Rock, Arkansas, former Assistant Attorney General Webb Hubble has pleaded guilty to mail fraud and tax evasion. Hubble is a former partner at the Rose Law Firm. As part of his plea, he agreed to cooperate in the Whitewater investigation. Prosecutor Kenneth Starr is looking into the business activities of the Clinton family and other prominent Arkansas residents, especially in connection with the failed Whitewater real estate deal. Treasury Secretary Lloyd Bentsen has announced his intention to resign, and President Clinton says he'll nominate Robert Rubin as his successor. Rubin is head of the president's National Economic Council that coordinates administration economic policy. At a White House ceremony, Rubin praised the president, saying his approach has improved the economy. But Rubin said much work remains, as too many Americans are not feeling the benefits of the economic recovery.
Mr. President, I don't believe, and I know you don't believe, that this country can be all that it should be for any of us unless it works for all of us. So, Mr. President, I believe, as you believe, that we must deal with the problems of our public education system, the problems of our inner cities, the problems of our ever-worsening income disparity, and the challenge of strengthening and expanding the nation's middle class. I welcome the opportunity to continue to work on these matters as a member of your economic team.
Treasury nominee Robert Rubin. Incoming Senate Majority Leader Bob Dole says he'll support Rubin, calling him a man of integrity. Ohio Democratic Senator Howard Metzenbaum is criticizing the Clinton administration's deal with General Motors. Last week, the Transportation Department announced a settlement with the automaker over charges that certain GM pickup trucks are unsafe. UPI's Pi Chamberlain reports.
General Motors agreed to pay about $50 million into safety programs, including the purchase of child safety seats for poor people. Senator Metzenbaum said that was not good enough and said all the trucks should have been recalled. These were pickups made between 1973 and 1987 with side-mounted gas tanks that caught fire more often than similar Ford pickups with center-mounted tanks.
The so-called settlement strikes me as the height of governmental irresponsibility.
Ralph Nader and others say they may try to overturn the arrangement, but it appears to be a done deal. Pi Chamberlain, Capitol Hill.
In Pensacola, Florida, former minister and anti-abortion activist Paul Hill has been sentenced to death. In October, a state jury convicted Hill of killing Dr. John Britton and his escort John Barrett outside a Pensacola clinic this summer. The judge today called the crime heinous and atrocious. Under Florida law, Hill gets an automatic appeal of his sentence. Outside the courtroom, some anti-abortion activists called Hill's actions justifiable homicide to save the lives of unborn babies. On Wall Street, stocks close mixed today. The Dow Jones Industrial Average rose 4 points to close at 3745.45. Declining issues led advances. This is NPR. The Miami government is sprucing up the city in preparation for this weekend's Western Hemisphere Summit. 200 miles of roads have fresh pavement, and city workers have planted 30,000 palm trees. The Dade County Commissioner says the summit gives Miami a chance to redefine itself, a reference to Miami's image as a high-crime area. Dade County consistently ranks among the top 10 crime regions in the country. The leaders of 33 nations will arrive on Friday for a two-day meeting that will focus largely on free trade. Secretary of State Warren Christopher has left Damascus, Syria, where he held talks with President Hafez al-Assad. The visit is part of Christopher's latest mission to the Middle East, his seventh this year. The BBC's Chris Morris reports.
Mr. Christopher has been carrying messages between the Israeli government and President Assad for months. This time he's brought a reply from the Israeli Prime Minister Yitzhak Rabin to a suggestion raised by Mr. Assad on the Secretary of State's last trip to the region with President Clinton in October. Mr. Clinton telephoned President Assad during the weekend to urge progress, but the Americans know from experience that this is a long negotiating process, which is some way from resolution. The fine details of the discussions are being kept confidential, but the main sticking point is the issue of Israeli withdrawal from the Golan Heights, which it captured from Syria in 1967. The Israelis have offered to withdraw gradually in return for a complete normalization of relations and security guarantees.
Chris Morris reporting. Democratic Leadership Council head Dave McCurdy is blaming President Clinton for the party's defeat in last month's elections. McCurdy is an Oklahoma congressman who lost his bid for the Senate in November. McCurdy says the president campaigned as a centrist politician but hasn't governed that way. McCurdy spoke at the DLC's 10th anniversary conference in Washington. President Clinton will speak to the organization at a dinner tonight. I'm Laura Kanoy, NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. A good reason to read Kevin Canty's short stories is sentences like these, in which a character describes his mentally ill mother. If you saw her on the street, you would see an ordinary woman, or slightly more interesting than ordinary, one of those well-off, independent women who approach their 50s in sneakers and naturally graying hair. You might suspect her of bird-watching, of having a visualized piece bumper sticker on her station wagon. You wouldn't imagine her naked on the bus, inviting the bus driver to have sex with her. You wouldn't think she had a knife in her purse, defense against a conspiracy she wouldn't name, afraid to say the words. Canty's debut collection of short stories is called A Stranger in This World. He always thought he would be a writer, but he spent many years not writing. He dropped out of high school, worked as a laborer, ran a business, and eventually went to grad school. He was first published in the 1992 summer reading issue of Esquire. He said that the moment he works toward in his stories is when the familiar world seems strange.
Most of us have a strong and inflated sense of our own ability to do the right thing. And I think that when people do get into trouble, when the world becomes unfamiliar, when the rules don't seem to help much, is when people discover the most about themselves. I know that that's true, has been true in my life, is that as long as everything is going along fairly well, I seem to be able to do fairly well. When things get difficult, then I find that I can surprise myself with the way that I act.
When has that happened to you?
Even as commonplace as falling in love, a lot of times you find that the rules have changed, that all of a sudden, you know, the normal parts of your life are subordinated to just where is this person and what's the shortest route between me and them. There are other times that have happened to me, and most of them are really too personal to want to talk about.
You seem to be very drawn to self-destructive behavior in your characters.
I thought you didn't have to end that right there. I am. I don't know why. I have a hard time writing about people who are leading relatively normal lives. I think that my own life right now, for instance, is fairly normal. I mean, I have two beautiful kids, and I'm married to a woman that I've known since 1976, and you know, I have a teaching job, and basically, my life would put a hummingbird to sleep. I mean, it's just dull. I think people in trouble are infinitely more interesting than people who aren't in trouble. And so that self-destructive impulse, I think, is something that I'm very interested in, because it's in some ways a war of the self against the self, the way that we can do things, and part of us knows that it's wrong, and yet we do them anyway. There are different parts of our personality, and in some ways they're at war with each other.
Have you ever been in serious trouble?
Oh, I don't know. Yes. I mean, yes. A year and a half ago, I was coming out of graduate school with no money and two kids and no job prospects. And I thought we were going, I was going down the tubes and taking my family with me. I mean, that seems fairly abstract. I mean, I was in all of the regular kinds of trouble in high school and some of the irregular kinds.
What saved you from that moment when you were out of grad school and broke and thinking you were looking ahead of trouble?
Extraordinarily good luck and some real a vote of confidence from the people at Doubleday who picked up on the book at that point and really solved a lot of problems for me at one stroke. But it was a very close thing. I mean, it's a strange thing to try to believe in yourself as an artist and to try to carry that along, and then all of a sudden to realize that it just might not work out, that you just might not be able to do this, no matter how badly you want to. And we didn't go over the edge, but we were as a family sort of looking down over there and seeing how far it really was to the bottom. And it was a very frightening experience.
I want you to read a bar scene from your first story. And this is where the father takes his son to a bar that the father hangs out in all the time. The son is 17, not quite drinking age.
The bartender set a Coke on the bar in front of me and a fresh gin and tonic in front of my father. I never saw him order it. A tilt of his head, a raised eyebrow, some signal the bartender understood. He drank gin in the summer and Manhattans in the winter. His glass looked clear and inviting, and it seemed to give off a faint phosphorescence, a glow, like a picture of a saint. We turned to the game, but I couldn't hold my interest in it. The Padres and somebody else. One of those late West Coast games that don't even seem to matter to the players. I looked around the bar, curious. It was the first time I'd ever been in one of my father's places for any length of time. Everyone seemed friendly enough, and the darkness of the place was pleasant, but I didn't understand what would bring people out of their houses to come here. It was a comfortable, quiet kind of bar anyway, with a jar of pickled eggs on the counter, Slim Jim sausages, potato chips, and those little foil packs of aspirin. A few couples scattered among the tables, a knot of men at the back, drinking beer and laughing, jet butts from the Naval Air Station, most likely. I sat on my bar stool, sipping my Coke, wondering why my father chose to spend his life here.
Is this passage based on a particular bar?
No, it's based on Bud's Bar in Prescott, Wisconsin. Yeah, no. A place I used to go in the summers to work on agricultural crews, and it was really the first bar that I ever spent any time in, and it was just in some ways still is the paradigm of the American bar for me.
I like the pig's feet along with those little foil packets of aspirin.
Yeah, we used to come in there after working for 12 or 14 hours out in the cornfields and sit there on these hot summer nights, and you know, you knew you had to be asleep, and you just sit in there drinking beer long past bedtime anyway. And it was just so, I mean, it was the one place, the first time that I ever discovered the bar as a kind of refuge from a life that, just a working class life. It's not at all hard to understand why people go to bars if you're outside working with your body in the hot sun all day. It is a kind of paradise.
My guest is Kevin Canty. He has a collection of short stories called A Stranger in This World. We'll be back after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is writer Kevin Canty. Did you grow up in a working class family?
No, not at all. My father was a magazine editor, has edited architectural magazines.
All
his professional life.
Because most of the main characters in your stories are from working class backgrounds.
Yeah, they are. Don't know. Beats me. So I spend a lot of time in the working class. I spend a lot of time just working. Around people, and to some extent, these are the stories of the people that I was around. when I was having ideas about stories. There's also a sense in which I think that a lot of the middle class life seems so sort of cushioned, contented. I just don't have the gift for getting through that in the way that Ann Beattie say can really penetrate through the sort of layers of comfort of the middle class life and get to the souls of her characters and make stories out of them. And I've tried, and sometimes I feel like I've almost succeeded, but most of the time I find that characters that are living a little bit closer to the economic edge have a little better apprehension of reality, or at least certainly a different version of reality.
Well, I think it's interesting that your father would edit an architectural magazine and you'd be writing about characters who live in trailers.
Sideways trailers.
So, but you've had a lot of, working class jobs. You've worked on a construction crew. What else have you done?
Well, I ran a sound business, sound reinforcement business in Portland for many years, Portland, mm-hmm. Oregon. And that's, it sounds romantic, but in fact it ends up being a lot of driving around in the middle of the night, hauling speaker cabinets to and fro. And, that was the reason that I was able to go to graduate school in writing, is that we built that business up and sold it. So that was really, one of those good old Ronald Reagan American success stories to some extent. Except that all of our clients were punk rockers. We started off as the only sound business in town that would deal with punk shows because everybody else was afraid of them.
Did the bands blow up the speakers a lot?
They tried, and we tried to keep them from blowing them up. And it was just usually, Merry Little War trying to see what was going on. There were the Johnny Thunders concert where they're using the microphone stand basses for Frisbees and throwing them around. or the early Dead Kennedy shows, or a lot of the early punk shows were just wild and a lot of fun.
Something else on your resume that I didn't quite understand. It says you were a Gandhi dancer when you worked for the Milwaukee Railroad. I don't know what a Gandhi dancer is.
A Gandhi dancer is a track laborer. It comes from the old days of the railroad when you'd be putting in new railroad ties, and you tamp gravel down underneath the railroad ties to keep the train from pressing it down. You use a short shovel with a D handle, like a spade with a D handle on it. So you'd have both of your hands down around your waist, around on the handle of the shovel, and you'd be tamping the gravel underneath the tie with your foot. And so it would look like a dancer. They named it Gandhi dancing. And Gandhi is the generic term for a railroad laborer these days.
Oh. So how long did you work for the railroad?
Oh, just a summer. It was the greatest summer job I'd ever had, though.
Why?
There were these lunatics that used to work there, the old railroad track guys, the old Gandhis who would live in the cars. They had these sleeping cars up there. They'd pay for their room and board. They'd get paid every 2 weeks. These guys had been on the road for all their adult lives, and they really didn't have anything. They'd go up to this little town, Wallace, Idaho, which was famous for its bars and houses of prostitution, and they'd go up there with a 2 weeks paycheck, and it was good money that we were making. And they'd come back with a can of top tobacco and $5, and just wild stories. These old guys would just go up there and tear the town up, and they'd work all summer making good money. At the end of the summer, they'd go out to Washington State and pick apples. It was the old time hobos that were working there that were really fascinating.
Kevin Candy is my guest. He has a collection of short stories called A Stranger in This World. Why did you drop out of high school?
I was bored silly. I was reminded of this. When I was up in, I was just up at a conference last weekend, and it was in Asheville, North Carolina, and it was a beautiful day, and the sun was shining, and I was sitting in a hotel conference room, with 100 other people talking about the writing process, and it was deadly dull, and I was sitting there looking out the window, And I realized that I had promised myself that I would never do this again, that I would never allow myself to be sitting in a room being bored like crazy and doing something that I didn't believe in, that I didn't think was a particularly useful way to spend my time, while there was a world out there too. There's just so many things to do. There's so many other things to do. And when I quit high school, I went to work on an all-black construction crew in suburban D.C., and learned so much about the realities of life in this country just from being on the bottom for a while. I was working with kids not much older than I was. I was 17 or 18, and they were 18 or 19, who were coming straight up from the South, who were married, had a couple kids, were trying to support a family in D.C. on a job that paid 25 cents over minimum wage. I think it was $2.75 an hour back then. And they were serious, straight people. They were really trying to make a life. They were really trying to stay on the right path. And I couldn't see how you could even possibly dream of supporting a family on that tiny amount of money. And yet to watch these people, these guys come into work day after day and just, they were straight, they would play it straight, they would show up, they would play by the rules as well as they could. And yet, you know, when the things got slow, those guys were the first ones to get fired.
You know how you described your writing as bits and pieces of things from your life that you've woven into a nest, making into something completely different?
Mm-hmm.
Can you describe a person or an image that's stuck with you, that found its way into a story, even though the story is unlike your life?
Yeah. I can give you the biography of the story Dogs, which is a story that's set in a dog pound in Tucson. And I've never worked in a dog pound, but I did actually kill gophers for a summer working for Missoula County, which is a job with some built-in moral questions. And so we were looking for a dog when we were living in Tucson. And we went out to the dog pound. And we didn't get a dog, but there was just this incessant noise, this incessant barking. It just never let up the whole time we were there. We were there for, half an hour tops. And it was driving me crazy. I mean, I had the feeling as we were driving away that I just had to get out of there. And then I thought, somebody's got that job. Somebody lives with that, 40 hours a week. And it didn't strike me as the sort of thing that you would get used to. And so that sort of stuck with me. And then I read a narrative, I think in the newspaper, about what actually happened at the dog pounds to the ones that weren't taken. And then about a week later, there was a story in the papers about how the night after greyhound racing was done for the year, they found the bodies of 24 racing dogs out in the desert with their ears clipped off. The ears have got the identifying tattoos on them, and so they were just, they clipped the ears so that the dogs couldn't be identified. Mm. And for some reason, I was just really led into a consideration of the sort of moral debt that we owe to dogs. And that visit to the dog pound gave me the character and the site and the surroundings. And that, all those things, and yet what pulled it together was the character, the central character in there. And he wasn't in any of those things that it came from, but he was somebody who was there to experience those things. He was there to be the person to whom these things happen. And, that was almost the entire genesis of that story.
Kevin Canty, his collection of short stories is called A Stranger in This World. He teaches at the University of North Carolina at Wilmington. This is Fresh Air. Robert Siegel's with us. Robert, what's coming up on All Things Considered?
Well, we'll have news of a change in the president's cabinet. Lloyd Bentsen is leaving as Secretary of the Treasury. He's to be succeeded by Robert Rubin, who's now the White House Assistant for Economic Affairs. Also on today's program, a story about the anti-illegal immigration movement, the movement that propelled Proposition 187 to such success in California, and how it's catching on in many other states around the Union right now. We'll also be hearing on today's program about a new prison, a high-tech prison in Florence, Colorado. Some people say that this is what is needed to deal with crime.
Thanks, Robert. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. In the U.S., we have curmudgeons who write language columns that rail against encroaching slang. In France, there's an academy with the official mission of protecting the language against slang and encroaching English expressions. Our linguist Jeff Nunberg, who recently returned from France, has been thinking about the French officials who stand watch over the language.
I once met a very congenial French socialist intellectual named Bernard Cercolini, who had the job of looking after all the government's programs aimed at maintaining the standards of the French language. He bore the remarkable title of General Delegate of the Prime Minister to the French language. It made him sound like an ambassador or plenipotentiary, as if the French language had set itself up as a nation of its own. But really, this isn't that far off. The language does have its own governing body in the form of the Académie Française. It's a self-perpetuating congress of 40 writers established 350 years ago by Cardinal Richelieu. The academicians assemble about twice a year in a dome building across the Seine from the Louvre. They wear oddly cut swallowtail coats covered with gold and green embroidery, with cocked hats topped with ostrich plumes and épées hanging at their sides. As it happens, Jean de Brunhoff took this as the model for the uniform that's worn by Babar's advisor Cornelius. And as the academicians file in, you might very well think of a procession of illustrious elephants and lions and monkeys and cranes, like the Council of Elders in a medieval bestiary. As a group, it's true, they don't actually do a great deal. They make speeches, and they work sporadically on a new edition of their dictionary. The last one appeared more than 60 years ago, and as best I can calculate, the academicians have been defining new words at a rate of about two or three a week, so this might take a while yet. The Academy's most important moment arrives when one of their number dies, which occasions a national flurry of discussion about whom the remaining 39 will elect to replace him. Guy de Maupassant once suggested that the chief criterion for membership should be advanced age, so that the public won't have to wait too long after a candidate's election for the pleasures of speculating about who his successor will be. But then the Academy, like the Vatican, has a chiefly spiritual authority. And this it takes very seriously, particularly in the years since the novelist Maurice Druon has been serving as its perpetual secretary. That title wouldn't be out of place in a Babar book either. Scarcely a week goes by that he doesn't fire off a letter to a newspaper or cabinet minister deploring some new slang or jargon. Above all, he battles constantly against the inroads of English, which he describes as spreading over the planet like a killer seaweed. Indeed, Druon is one of the world's great language cranks. He can summon up a dyspeptic indignation that makes critics like Edwin Newman and John Simon seem merely petulant by comparison. But then, of course, Druon knows that the ministers will answer his letters respectfully, and that his readers will have to treat these things as if they were matters of the highest national importance. That's how it is that he can begin a recent book with the words, "Frenchmen, do you still love France? Do you still love yourselves? Listening to you speak, one has one's doubts." Can you imagine William Sapphire beginning one of his language columns by saying, "Americans, do you still love your country?" I mean, excuse me, what are we talking about here? Adverbs? It isn't that the French love their language more than we do, but theirs is a narcissistic passion. All those fulgurations about the state of French are part of an age-old debate about the cultural foundation of the nation. The issue can still evoke high passions, most recently in the controversies over the recent law that restricted the use of English words on television and in advertising, which split both the left and the right. Of course, it all seems a bit silly from over here. Just fancy us dressing our great writers up in swords and feathered hats. On the other hand, just fancy our cabinet secretaries returning their phone calls.
Jeff Nunberg is a linguist associated with Stanford University and the Xerox Palo Alto Research Center. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, and Naomi Person, with Alan Tu and Nancy Updike. Research assistance from Becky Cohn. Sienna Christman is our intern. I'm Terry Gross.
Fresh Air is now available on cassette. To order, call 1-800-934-6000. That's 1-800-934-6000. The cost is $9.95 plus shipping and handling. Not all programs are available.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Last week, Wynton Marsalis announced he was breaking up his septet to devote his energies to running Lincoln Center's jazz program. On the next Fresh Air, we talk with trumpet player and composer Wynton Marsalis. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.